ஓம் நம சிவாய. டியர் லிசனர்ஸ் ஆஃப் சைவம் டாட் ஆர்க், தி நெக்ஸ்ட் ப்ரோக்ராம் இஸ் ஸ்பிரிச்சுவல் டிஸ்கோர்ஸ். இன் திஸ் யூ ஆர் அபவுட் டு லிசன் கவாய் ஹிந்து லெக்சர்ஸ். தி டைட்டில்ஸ் ஆர் பேப்ஸ் ஒபே குரு பார்ட் 2, சோல் வேர்ல்ட், பிரசன்டட் பை ஸ்ரீ சிவாய போதிநாத வேலாயுத சுவாமி. தேங்க் யூ. Om Namah Shivaya.
We're going to continue on our talk for New Delhi, Swami Narayan group. For those who weren't here for the first part, we have an invitation from the BAPS Swami Narayan Sansta to be present and give a talk at the opening of their very, very large center in New Delhi. And the celebration is a month long, and we're there during the last week of it, which is set aside for foreign dignitaries. So there'll be more English-speaking people there that week that we're there. So we're scheduled to give a talk, and they've asked for the importance of obeying one's guru. This is because Gurudeva gave a famous talk to them on that subject in 1995 in Bombay at their leader's, Pramukh Swami's, birthday party. Something like 30,000 people attending the birthday party there. They like to do things on a large scale. So I think they anticipate, just a small crowd of 10,000 when I give this talk. So, plus, I think national television coverage possibly. So, the editing team went over this very carefully. So, see where we were here. So we talked about the guru. Did that. So here's a good, I think these last couple of paragraphs we read, but we can read them again. It gives good continuity. So Gurudeva gave them three suggestions at that talk. Obey your guru, obey your guru, and obey your guru. Those were his three suggestions. So my talk mentions that, then it goes on as in this way. Let's look more closely at exactly what it means to obey the guru. The basic way to be obedient is to strictly follow the general principles taught by the guru. These are traditionally found in the scriptures of the lineage, such as the verses of the Shikshapatri. These 212 verses are certainly comprehensive in covering all aspects of life, and Swami Narayan followers are indeed fortunate to have such a clear set of principles laid out to follow in this code of precepts. You may be interested to know that the Shikshapatri inspired our Gurudeva to develop a similar scripture for his monks and families. It consists of 365 verses, one for each day of the year, and is called the Nandinada Sutras. These sutras now guide our Sampradaya just as the Shikshapatri guides BAPS. The importance of obeying the rules of the Shikshapatri is stated by Bhagwan Swami Narayan in verses 205 and 206. Hence, all my disciples shall observe all the rules laid down in the Shikshapatri and shall never follow the whims of the lower instincts. Those of my disciples who shall live in accordance with the precepts laid down here shall attain all the four desired objects, dharma, artha, kama, moksha, on earth. A second form of obedience is to follow any personal advice given to us by the guru. Some Hindus select a guru who is no longer living. They place his picture on their wall and altar and study his writings. I call this a safe guru because he will never ask you to do something you do not want to do. Whereas a living guru will, in fact, quite often ask you to do exactly what you do not want to do. Being obedient and doing what the Satguru has requested may prove to be quite challenging. However, in accomplishing the task, you will have made progress on the spiritual path, for he sees better than you do the karmas of your life and how you can overcome them. Let's take as an example a disciple who is quite shy of public speaking. His shyness is based upon a few experiences in school in which he did very poorly in speaking in front of his class. These experiences convince him that others are better than he is. It would be natural for the guru to ask him to do that very thing. For example, to speak in front of a large satsang group every week until he overcomes his shyness of speaking in public. These positive accomplishments improve his self-concept to the point where he realizes he is neither greater nor lesser than anyone else because, in truth, he is the divine being within him. He is not the outer personality, the ego. Rather, he is the inner soul. This change would not have occurred if he did not have a living Satguru directing him to do exactly what he was least inclined to do. In verse 2-51 of the Vachan Amrit, Bhagwan Swaminarayan stresses the importance of following the commands of the Guru. Only one who follows the commands of the Satpurush can be said to be under the influence of favorable circumstances. To deviate from those commands is the very definition of adverse circumstances. Therefore, only one who follows the commands of the Satpurush is behaving as the Atma. Obedience is a word that does not fall easily from most people's tongues in these modern times. But it is an essential quality of good character, and we should not be afraid of the idea, even if others are. In truth, obedience is the guiding principle of families, businesses, peacekeeping forces, and of course, spiritual institutions all around the world, of every faith. Obedience is one of the five vows that all monks of our yoga order take. Let me share with you three excerpts from Gurudeva's description of the vow of obedience. Each elucidates a different dimension of this virtue. Obedience is the state of willingness and cooperation in which the soul remains open and amenable to enlightened direction. For the devotee, it is an unbroken pledge of trust in and surrender to the Satguru, the Guru Parampara, and the mystic process of spiritual evolution. Obedience does not consist in blind submission and yielding to authority, nor in weakening our own will that it may be dominated by the will of another. Yet it is, in another sense, submission to a sacred purpose and the divine authority of the inner worlds. It is for the devotee an inner quality that allows one to remain consciously tractable and responsive. At those times when the instinctive nature looms strong and there arises a sense of I and mine, obedience is a surrendering of the ego to the soul, or the instinctive nature to the spiritual nature. As long as the ego dominates the life of man, he will experience obedience as capitulation or subjection. As the soul unfolds further, obedience is perceived as the union of minds and purpose, a state of harmony so complete that there can exist no distinction between him who gives and him who receives instruction or direction. True obedience is based on agreement, trust, and knowledge, as opposed to passive servility, non-resistance, or domination, which have ignorance and fear as their basis. Here's a story from our Guru Parampara I would like to share that illustrates this concept of obedience. It occurred when our Parama Guru Yogaswami was still being trained by his Guru Jalapaswami. The year was around 1905, a century ago. Amidst a festival crowd at a large temple, Jalapaswami told him, "Go within meditate, stay here until I return. Chalapaswami came back 3 days later to find Yogaswami still waiting for him to return. A soul of lesser dedication would have rationalized that Chalapaswami had forgotten about him, and therefore it was all right to leave, return home, have a meal, and sleep. Yogaswami, however, dutifully complied with his guru's instructions to wait until he returned, even though staying there for 3 days was a clear hardship, and he had no idea when the guru would return. Returning to the vow of obedience, I would like to quote again from our sadhu's vows, which describe how the devotee can work his mind closely with the mind of his sadguru. Obedience may be defined as wisdom in handling directions and instructions. The devotee must learn to work closely with the mind of his sadguru, seeking to bring his awareness ever closer to that of his preceptor. He must work to learn the art of accepting direction, whether expressed or implied, and fulfilling it beyond the expectations of his sadguru. He must remain open to change, never allowing his mind to become so inflexible, so settled in its ways, that it cannot respond. He must take upon himself the responsibility for clarifying directions that are not clear, never executing directions thoughtlessly, and then casting blame on those who made them. He must respond with a full heart, never subtly resisting directions he has received. He must respond quickly and with full energy, never using delay or lethargy as a means of imposing or impeding authority, for even delay and resistance are forms of disobedience. He must always seek agreement and a merging of minds with his fellow devotees, never supporting or sustaining contention or disagreement, or stubbornly clinging to an opposite point of view. My guru often stressed the difference between intelligent cooperation and blind obedience. He stated it like this: we must remember that blind obedience is never the spiritual way. It is intelligent cooperation that is the binding force in a well-run ashram. Intelligent cooperation means obtaining an extremely clear understanding of what is requested to be done before proceeding. Often this requires asking questions, discussing the direction or project, as one would do in a modern corporation. Then, once all is understood, making the leader's direction your own direction. This is intelligent cooperation, not blind obedience. Let me share a third and final section of the vow of obedience that gives suggestions on how to cultivate, meaning nurture, obedience. The devotee cultivates obedience through faithfully following the customs of his lineage. He cultivates obedience through listening carefully to directions he may receive and then carrying out those directions without changing them to suit his own preferences or perceptions. He cultivates obedience by conscientiously following not only overt instructions, but those subtle, unspoken directions that may come from his satguru, senior sadhus, and his own conscience. He cultivates obedience through neither forgetting nor neglecting instructions, even years later. He cultivates obedience by contemplating, in the absence of instructions, what his satguru would do or expect of him, and not taking such instances as opportunities to express his own ideas. He cultivates obedience by being loyal to his spiritual heritage and customs, holding fast to the ancient wisdom. What is the right thing to do in the absence of instructions from the satguru? Some devotees would look at this as an opportunity to express and act upon their own viewpoints. That approach, if followed by a group of devotees, would lead to each expressing his or her own personal opinion and therefore could lead to serious disagreements between the members of the group. This scenario is totally avoided when each devotee in the group seeks to determine what his satguru would do or expect him to do if he were physically present. In conclusion, having a living Satguru provides the devotee with an opportunity to make significant spiritual progress in a single lifetime. However, as we previously mentioned, this progress is not automatic. It only occurs when the devotee is strictly obedient to the general rules of conduct of the lineage and follows carefully and fulfills in the right spirit all personal instruction received from the Satguru. Then there's a paragraph just for them. How fortunate you all are in having a Satguru such as Swami Sri. He attends to all the details of your life. He responds personally in his own handwritten notes to every letter and question you send to him. How rare a soul he is to love you so deeply. You can thank him in three ways. What do you think they are? Obey your guru. Obey your guru. Obey your guru. Right. So that's the second half. Be interesting. See what all the response is. I think it'll be good. So I think the talk points out quite nicely many of the subtleties of obeying the guru. And I like the one about not blind obedience. I think that's very, very useful, because sometimes the concept we get, you know, possibly from something we read in a book somewhere, is the guru tells you to do something and you don't even think about it really, you just go do it. Guru says, go jump off a cliff. You go jump off a cliff or something. If he asked me to jump off a cliff. So Gurudeva says, no, that's not the fullness of the concept. You know, if we don't understand an instruction, we should ask. Of course, asking means asking at the proper time and the proper way. You know, for example, if a guru is giving a talk, something inspired, and says something, and then in the middle of it you ask a question, you can lose the whole inspiration, lose the whole vibration of the talk by asking a question at the wrong time. So that's also part of the sensitivity. We need to, if we don't understand something, Gurudeva is saying you need to ask. But what wasn't mentioned there is you have to ask at a good time and in an appropriate way. You can't ask at the wrong time, and you can't ask with the wrong attitude, kind of a critical attitude or an antagonistic attitude. So it's similar idea. I was thinking about this in another context. Sometimes we think if an idea is right, if our concept is right, then we're right. You know, but I like to say, well, you have to be right three times, not just one time. So what are the other two times? Well, you have the right idea, but you have to express it in the right way at the right time. You have to be right three times. In order to really be right, to have the right idea, express it at the wrong time or in the wrong way, you know, obviously it doesn't work out. So you have to figure out how to be right three times, not just once. And then it all works out in a nice way. So that's our thought for the day, for a wonderful phase. Well, we're going off to California, aren't we, day after? No, it's tomorrow. Tomorrow, right? Leaving tomorrow for California. First time to San Diego for an event. Everyone down there is really high, you know, happy, jumping up and down. And we're going up to the... That's for Friday and Saturday. We're having a satsang on Friday and then a donor appreciation reception, we call it, for lunch on Saturday. and flying up San Francisco Saturday evening early, and then Sunday we have satsang and then a donor reception in the late afternoon in Sausalito. It's a very nice place right on the bay there. You look out the window and you see the bay and sailing boats sailing by and so forth. Very attractive. Om Namah Shivaya. Good morning, everyone. Nice to see you. Good to be back. Our whirlwind weekend. Lots of good pictures on Taka. I've been there, and I guess we have a few more coming as well. All the events. We basically had two formal events in San Diego and two in Northern California. One was, in each place, one was a satsang for members and devotees, and the other was a a reception for a broader group of Hinduism Today readers and Yerevan donors and well-wishers and friends. So it went very well, and everyone said, please come back next year. So I'll certainly try to do that. So I thought I'd read a little bit from this material here. It was prepared for the Saturday morning seminar in Montreal that hasn't happened yet. It's part of the Kumbhabhishekam there, and Temple asked us to give a 45-minute presentation followed by questions and answers. So I thought I'd read from part of that. Goes through five beliefs and five practices. So this is the fifth belief, Patipasupasam, God, soul, and world. So the God part I won't read. We all know what it's going to say. It talks about Shiva and his five actions. So jump to the soul. Let's talk about the soul. Our individual soul is the immortal and spiritual body of life that animates life and reincarnates again and again until all necessary karmas are created and resolved, and its essential unity with God is fully realized. Our soul is God, Shiva's emanational creation, the source of all of our higher functions, including knowledge, will, and love. Our soul is neither male nor female. It is that which never dies, even when its four outer sheaths, physical, pranic, instinctive, and mental, change form and perish as they naturally do. Simple way to think of the soul is as a light that is controlled by a variable light switch, the kind where you turn it to the right, the kind where when you turn it to the right, the light gets brighter. When the soul is created, the light switch is turned to the left. In other words, the light of the soul is dim. Each time we live a life in a religious manner, the switch turns to the right and the light becomes brighter. In great Satgurus, the switch is all the way to the right, and the light of their soul is quite bright. Many Hindu traditions believe that the soul is identical with God. There is an often quoted verse from the Upanishads on this, which is Aham Brahmasmi, which means, I am God. The idea is that if we go deeply enough inside ourselves, inside our soul, we find God and realize that everything and everyone is God. Here's a Yogaswami story to illustrate the idea of oneness. Once a devotee of Yogaswami's had a bath, wore clean clothes, and was getting ready to see Swami. However, he was saddened by the thought that his heart was not as clean as his body and clothes. He couldn't control his mind and was descending further into sinful ways. His thoughts were so despicable that he could not even discuss it with his friends. He felt that even his parents would despise him if they knew. He was ashamed to go before Swami with such thoughts. But being an ardent devotee, he couldn't keep away either. So he decided he would prostrate himself before Swami and cry his heart out. On the way, he hoped that Swami would not be in meditation, because if he was, then he would perceive his evil thoughts. As he entered the ashram, he found Swami happily conversing with his disciples. "I have escaped," thought the devotee, as he worshipped him. Then Swami looked at him with a smile and said, "I know everything from your head to your toes. I know all your thoughts, not only yours, but everybody's. I am in everybody. You do not know this because you think of yourself as being separate from others. Learn to consider yourself as the same as others and not separate." Then, taking the camphor tray that was burning before him, he gave it to his devotee and said, "Take this light, and considering everyone here to be Shiva, worship them." Why is it, then, that we feel separate from other people and from God? It is because the three bonds of anava, karma, and maya veil our sight. This is Shiva's purposeful limiting of awareness, which allows us to evolve. Gurudeva elaborates in Dancing with Shiva. Just as children are kept from knowing all about adult life until they have matured into understanding, so too is the soul's knowledge limited. We learn what we need to know, and we understand what we have experienced. Only this narrowing of our awareness, coupled with a sense of individualized ego, allows us to look upon the world and our part in it from a practical, human point of view. Pascha is the soul's triple bondage, maya, karma, and anava. Without the world of maya, the soul cannot evolve through experience. Karma is the law of cause and effect, action and reaction, governing maya. Anava is the individuating veil of duality, source of ignorance and finitude. Maya is the classroom, karma the teacher, and anava the student's ignorance. The three bonds or malas are given by Lord Shiva to help and protect us as we unfold. Yet God Shiva's all-knowingness and the oneness of all may be experienced for brief periods by the meditator who turns within to his own essence. Let's look more closely at the concept of anava. Anava is the impurity of smallness, the finitizing principle. The presence of anavamala is what causes the misapprehension about the nature of God, soul, and world, the notion of being separate and distinct from God and the universe. A simple way to grasp the concept of anava is to think of a bucket and the ocean waters. You can dip the bucket in the ocean and lift it up. The water that is in it is now separate from the ocean. The bucket is like anava. It has separated a small amount of water from the ocean's water. The water is consciousness, a small amount of which is now separate. There is a verse from the Yajurveda which describes this process. A part of infinite consciousness becomes our own finite consciousness, with powers of discrimination and definition and with false concepts. He is, in truth, Prajapati, and Vishva, the source of creation and the universal in us all. This spirit is consciousness and gives consciousness to the body. He is the driver of the chariot. Let's look for a moment at the Saivasiddhanta concept of the world, which is referred to as Maya or Mayai. In Yogaswami's words of our master, collection of statements he made throughout his life, there are two statements about the world. The first is, the world is a training school. Some are in kindergarten and some are in the BA class. Yogaswami's second statement is, the world is an ashram, a training ground for the achievement of freedom. Each one does his part according to his own measure. There is nothing that is evil. Another view of the world, of Maya, held by some Hindus is the perspective that the world is an illusion. This is the view that for spiritual progress to occur, the world must simply be renounced. For advanced renunciate monks, this can be a helpful perspective. For For the rest of Hindu humanity, it is definitely not a helpful perspective, as it keeps us from engaging in the world with a positive spiritual attitude toward it. Looking at the world as illusion is like a schoolboy or girl looking at school as an illusion. He or she will definitely miss the value of the experience. Looking at the world as an ashram emphasizes that being in the world is an opportunity to make spiritual progress. The question naturally arises, are we taking full advantage of this opportunity? A common situation we all face is being mistreated either by others' actions or others' words. The way we respond determines if we are making spiritual progress or not. Let's take the simple example of a situation at work where a coworker regularly takes all the pens from our desk for his own use. Here are some possible responses. Number one, every time he takes pens from our desk, we retaliate and take all the pens from his desk when he is out to lunch. Number two, we hold the belief that it is wrong to retaliate, but still we hold a grudge against him for his actions. This resentment keeps the subconscious mind disturbed. Number three, we completely forgive the person for his actions and let the matter go. Number four, we buy a box of pens for him and give it to him with the statement that he always seems to be running out of pens, thought he could use a few extra. This last response is an example of the Tutukural principle. If you return kindness for injuries received and forget both, those that harmed you will be punished by their own shame. So that's a very high-minded principle, to punish someone by their own shame. In other words, you are encouraging the individual to improve his behavior by showing him kindness instead of retaliation. I'm sure you can all think of other responses that would accomplish this same high-minded purpose as expressed by the Tirukkural. In conclusion, as Paramaguru Yogaswami says, the world is an ashram, a training ground for the achievement of freedom. It is up to us to hold that perspective when we are in the world and respond in a spiritual manner to whatever experiences we encounter. Thank you.